were a few changes in committee structure this year, but we didn't get touched, which I think is good. They're all very great Americans and capable members of this committee.
Still the committee.
It's no surprise that the challenges ahead facing economy and the state, and I think this committee is going to be looking at a lot of things that have to be looked at. There will be challenges, but we've gotten through things before in the past, and we'll somehow do it again. So today we have a couple of interesting agenda items, a presentation of the employment and workers workforce. Of course, the workforce development stuff is, again, like I said a minute ago, is more important than ever going forward, I think. And the second issue will be the jobs issue that we've talked about actually at length last year, and I think the auditor was involved there, and I know Senator Bach was involved in the jobs thing, and there was some language in, I believe, in his bill, too, but we'll see how that... how things are going there. So with that, welcome. Oh, we have a new clerk or page. Nicole Holstein is in the green there. So welcome. Otherwise, we... Are you new to this committee? No. Yeah, otherwise, we're all right. So with that, we'll start with Steve Hine, Research Director, Labor Market Information Office of DEET. Welcome to the committee, and everybody, of course, that testifies... Introduce yourself for the tape. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to come before you today and brighten your day with an assessment of what our labor markets look like currently and in the future.
Do we want to know?
we're going to know. You need to know. My name is Steve Hine. I'm the research director at DEED. Head up the Labor Market Information Office. As such, we're the people responsible for those employment and unemployment figures that come out each month and other sources of information as well. Is this loud enough?
Yeah, you're fine. Okay.
All right. Next. There we go. Okay. I'd like to start by looking at some of the conditions that face us in the short term, and then briefly, towards the end of my time here, look at some of the longer-term challenges that we will face. They're markedly different than what we currently are looking at over the next year or two. I want to show that Minnesota began to slow down somewhat before the nation did. We began to slow down in early 2006, and of course the nation went into official recession at the very end of 2007. We'll see that the weakness that we've experienced, in some contrast to the most recent previous recession, has spanned all sectors in our economy. Our low unemployment rate advantage that we have experienced for over 30 years until just recently has diminished or disappeared. Looking at some short-term forecasts that are based on the information that we're getting from Global Insight, suggests that this weakness will continue for the next couple of years, at least through the end of 2009, which would make it the longest recession, if the recession were to officially last that long in the post-war period. And further and finally also that by many measures, the degree of labor market slack that we're going to be facing in the upcoming year or so is going to be of historic proportions. So our recession not only looks to be long, but quite deep as well.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bach.
Maybe before we go to another slide, the bullet that says our unemployment advantage has diminished. I think it was June of 07 when we first saw the Minnesota unemployment rate higher than the national average in the 30 years we've been tracking numbers. And kind of persistently since then, it's happened several times. Do we know what's caused that? Are we going to be stuck with that? Or what? Something changed in our marketplace that's not a short-term problem? Or
Senator Bach, members of the committee, that's a very good question, whether we'll continue to persist at or near the national unemployment rate is one of those big unresolved questions as to why we got there. We certainly started to experience that slowdown that I mentioned earlier. That's at about the time we began to edge towards that national unemployment rate, and we were hit relatively hard early on because of our exposure to some of the housing-related conditions that precipitated the national recession. So we began to see some of the impact in residential construction and specialty trades, of course, but also some of the other areas that were particularly highly concentrated in, like wood products manufacturing. So it was, I'd say if there were an explanation, and I'm not saying that this is the only explanation or even that it's correct, but the nature of the current recession, the housing market conditions and the spillover into those areas that were closely related to housing conditions were what drove us back towards that national unemployment rate initially.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I ask that because when you look at aggregate personal income in Minnesota, for decades we were kind of in the top decile of states. We were growing pretty fast for a long time, and it appears like that we're slipping there in total personal income earned in the state. And it seems like some other states are catching us and have even surpassed us in personal income growth, and which is probably as important as the unemployment numbers. So I'm just wondering if you have any observations about what might be going on in other places that we actually are slipping out of that top decile of states and are settling in more towards the middle of the pack.
Yeah, Senator Bach, there are certainly a complex and large number of issues that are related to our relatively slow growth in personal income, our relatively higher rate of unemployment. That is certainly a topic that's being discussed widely, and I'm not prepared really to address those beyond speculation at this point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hine, when you figure that out, would you share it with me?
I will. Thank you.
Mr. Hine, let me just follow up for 1 second on that.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Hine, if Minnesota started going in the tank long before the economy started going in the tank, what's the reason for that?
Probably the...
Senator Tomasoni, we really started to see the impact of the housing market bubble deflating it was becoming pretty apparent in about mid 2005. We started to see some significant slowdown in activities related to residential housing at about that time. We began to see our slowdown as the next, let me put this up, this will help me answer the question. We can see that we started to deviate from the national employment level at about that time in early 2006. We certainly saw the impact of that housing market correction in terms of our employment, again, in those areas like wood products, earlier than much of the rest of the nation did, that didn't have that same exposure to that kind of adjustment in the markets.
Well, I mean, talked a couple times about housing, but I mean, you look at Florida or Arizona or Michigan or California, and other states are as bad or worse off than us. And, I mean, that's one of the factors, what you said, but I mean, the shift.
Senator Metzen, that's absolutely true, and their rate of employment declines and their increase in unemployment rate do reflect that they have been impacted to even a greater extent. But they did not have that same exposure early on in the adjustment process, the immediate reaction to the beginning of the housing crisis.
You're saying it's more of a timing thing, huh?
Yes, absolutely. I'm trying to point out that in early 2006, we began to see the impact because of that high concentration in housing-related industries that other states did not experience.
All right. Certainly, there's got to be
more factors that we're not getting here this afternoon yet, but Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I noticed that the commissioner's in the audience, and I wondered if he might want to step to the podium and share some of his thoughts as to the questions that have been raised.
Okay. Welcome, Commissioner. And
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm happy to share some thoughts, although
Commissioner, even though we all know you and you're one of our favorite commissioners, you have to identify yourself.
For the record, I'm Dan McElroy, and I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And Dr. Hine and his team work with the U.S. Department of Labor to bring the kind of the factual basis to this. And we have been very concerned in watching this very closely. The fact that we started to slow down faster than the nation, a fair amount of it had to do with things that had been good news earlier in the 90s. We've had 7 oriented strand board or plywood or building board plants that have considerable employment in northern and northeastern Minnesota. Only 2 of them are operating currently. 4 are completely shut down. 1 is in sort of mothball status. That makes a big difference. We have 2 of the largest window manufacturers in North America. They're both slower than they would like to be. We have significant components in kitchen cabinets and in paint and doors and a wide variety of other things. I just asked our economic analysts group separate from Steve's group if they could give me an estimate of how many jobs we have lost related to single-family construction, the specialty trades, building materials distribution, and building materials manufacturing. And their estimate is that since the summer of 2005, we've lost about 27,000 jobs in those areas. And I think our total, it gets confusing because we've also had some gains during that time. But our net loss during that period is about 30,000, Steve? 31,000?
Less than that.
Less even. Than that, mm-hmm. High 20s. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to overestimate the impact that the housing decline has had on Minnesota's economy. I would like to get to the personal income issue that Senator Bach and Senator Tomasoni raised. There was an alarm bell that went off in the first quarter of 2008 when we showed up as having, for that one quarter, the 48th fastest increase in personal income. And we were only Mississippi and Alabama were behind us. Turned out that that was an anomalous quarter. That didn't continue to show up in subsequent quarters. For the period that ended third quarter 08 compared to third quarter 07, we're back about where we had been in the top dozen or 14. We were 12th for 2007 in personal income, only $91 per person out of the top 10. The next highest in the region is North Dakota at 24th. So we continue to do reasonably well. We would like to do better. But that first quarter was an anomaly. It did not continue to be as alarming in second and third quarter or for the year.
Senator Bach, Commissioner, do we have a trend line of where we were in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s in personal income, kind of in a decile of states and where we are today? Because I'm under the understanding we've kind of our growth has flattened off.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Senator Bach, I've seen it for the 90s to the current, and we'll make that available. I don't think I've seen it further back than that. And I believe you're right. It's not as alarming as it was in the first quarter, but we're not growing as fast as we had been earlier. Part of that is, it's related to the unemployment rate and in relatively high-paying industries. Just that downturn in single-family residential reflected $400 million a year in lost payroll. That's a big number when you start dividing that into 5 million people and you get a per capita personal income.
Okay.
I'm going to step back and let Dr. Hine give you all the facts. If there are other questions, I'm happy to come back to the table.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Senator Metzen. Well, I'm on slide 3 of 20-some, so I better pick it up.
The chamber thing is at 5:30.
So I wanted to include this slide just as a way of providing some context. Picture tells 1,000 words. I'm not going to go anywhere near that many. But I did want to point out that, first of all, during the 2001 recession, we lost 54,000 jobs. So that puts our current job loss that we'll talk about here in some context. One thing that was markedly unusual about that recession and the subsequent recovery here in Minnesota was the long period of time it took for us to regain the jobs that we lost. It was over 4 years before we finally regained our previous employment peak. We then experienced 2 years from 2004 through early part of 2006 where we tracked the national job growth rate very closely. But again, beginning in early 2006, we started to lag behind. And if we sort of extrapolated what our previous job growth rate had been, had we not experienced that slowdown, it amounted to about a 47,000 job shortfall in the 2 years between early 2006 and early last year. We have since the Twin Cities area, I would guess, pretty parallel with the rest of the state. Yeah, and since peaking here in the state in March of last year, we've now lost about 39,000 jobs. The nation, of course, since peaking in December, has lost a little over 2 million jobs. If we contrast that with the 1990s, all right, we outpaced the national job growth rate throughout that decade, throughout that expansionary period, at a rate that produced about 500,000 more jobs than the rate at which we have been expanding since the 2001 recession. Now, unfortunately, we're also forecasted to go even lower. These are quarterly job changes in the past as well as those that are projected in the future by Global Insight. Now, this is not meant to supplant or contradict anything that would come from Tom Stinson's office in the course of budget projection preparation, but if the state job growth rate matches what Global Insight is projecting for the nation, 2009 will bring about another 60,000 plus job loss on top of that 39,000 that we've already lost, with a turnaround then beginning to occur in the first quarter of 2010 and a fairly substantial recovery subsequent to that.
We hope, yeah. Senator?
I would say that using the Global Insight has been very much a moving target over the past few months, that their forecasts have dramatically become more pessimistic.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hine. When Dr. Stinson was talking to the Tax Committee about the modeling that he was using, he said that the changes were so great that they were outside of any expectation of norm for modeling, and it's extremely hard to assess the accuracy of what you're predicting. And I'm going to ask you the same question when I look at your recovery in 2010 and 11. What kind of reliability do you put on that?
Thank you, Senator Skoy. The beauty of my methodology here is that I can defer those questions and uncertainties to Global Insight. I'm simply applying their national forecast to our own state numbers. So Dr. Stinson's absolutely right that it's been very much a fool's errand to try to predict what might happen a year or two down the road when those predictions change so dramatically month to month.
I think we're going to get into a little later, too, if there's any on this Obama stimulus thing, if anybody's how that works into these numbers, and if anybody knows about that, and what the state is doing.
That's absolutely right.
What the state is doing to go after those dollars even now,
yeah,
and not wait till later. But that could greatly, yes, I would think, affect those numbers.
Yes, Global Insight spells out what they anticipate with regard to a stimulus package, but how that might affect state by state may be quite different.
All right, so that's in there already. Senator Latz first, and then Senator Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hine, how does this translate to unemployment rate?
I'll be showing you that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And also, when you get to that underemployment, effective full-time versus part-time, and people who drop out of the job market altogether and wouldn't be counted technically in an unemployment rate as a result.
Absolutely. I could certainly address that perhaps when we start talking about unemployment.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Bach.
Well, Dr. Hine, I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that nationally we need to build about 1.6 million housing units a year to keep up with demand, and that this last year we actually built 650,000, a million short of what the country really needs in new housing stock. My question is, do we have any numbers in Minnesota? If most of our job losses have been in the housing area, is our population growing fast enough that we are creating some pent-up demand for housing that we might see, you know, a pretty quick turnaround because of the demand, the future demand that we're not building right now? Does Minnesota have any numbers on that? I mean, if most of our losses have been in the housing area and we're not building them right now and our population's growing, there must be some opportunity at some point that we're going to turn up. And I'm just wondering how much pent-up demand we might be building.
Yes, Senator Bach, you're asking things that are beyond my realm of expertise with regard to housing stocks and pent-up demand. I would want to clarify that while our exposure to the housing market slowdown precipitated the recession here earlier, if you want to call it, it's slowed down earlier than it did nationally. It's certainly not the case that we have lost more jobs in that area than in many other areas that have been quite hard hit by the rippling out of that throughout the economy. Perhaps the commissioner is sitting down with housing stock-related information.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we have done some work on this, and the Builders Association of Minnesota has done some work. And I thought perhaps I had the exact numbers with me, and I do not. But my recollection is in 2005 we had something like 40,000 single-family building permits in Minnesota, and we'll have fewer than 10,000 this year, so we're down about 75%. We can get you those exact numbers. The Builders Association is working with their national association on a program called Fix Housing First, in which they believe that some combination of making credit more available, providing some assistance on the national level could speed things up. But we have followed essentially the national pattern. I think we're down from at one point. The long-term need they documented is similar to what you had, about 1.4 million housing starts a year. We had reached a bubble in 2005 of perhaps 2.2 or 2.3, and that we'll be below 600,000 this year. And Minnesota has followed that pattern.
Before you can build and sell new ones, there's probably a heavy inventory out there today sitting of homes, I would guess. I don't know what the numbers are, but I know it's a huge number in Minnesota that are two-thirds of the 7/8 built and birds are flying through the windows and no copper in them anymore. You've got to get over that hurdle or part of that hurdle before you get to the next step, I think, Senator Bach. So that's a good – I don't know. I don't have all the answers, but interest rates are going down quite a bit here lately. So.
And you may wish to hear from the Builders Association. They have a great deal more information on that topic.
Yeah, because there's a big inventory out there. I know that. Senator Scheid? Senator Latz again. Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and either Dr. Hine or Commissioner, in what you're looking at – do you have any idea how need or of housing stock would be defined? You know, if you're dealing with single-family residential versus multifamily housing in terms of meeting the need for shelter for population growth, whether the definition of need was perhaps artificially inflated by artificially provided credit for people who might not have been creditworthy or should not have gotten into mortgages that they shouldn't have bought houses because they didn't have the financial ability to do so, but were given easy credit to do that. Any way to factor that in, or has it been factored in any of them?
I think that the point about we're speaking as an economist with a labor market emphasis and not a housing emphasis, we would certainly expect to see some the need for the freeing up of the wherewithal to begin purchasing houses. Now, I did look at a series lately that I tried to seasonally adjust so that I could look at short-term trends on closed sales, monthly closed sales statewide. And we have seen the last couple of months start to turn up for the first time since late 2005. So at least by that measure, and it's very short term, I wouldn't look at any 1 month bump up as being significant, but 2 months is more than twice as good as 1 month, that we do see some sign by that measure that we're starting to see that activity ramping up in the sale of existing homes. Beyond that, I don't have the wherewithal to address that.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, all I had seen was the historic comparison to what the average had been prior to the bubble, and I have not seen a good analysis of kind of the income-based need. The Builders Association has done some more research on that and may be of more assistance.
All right, you've got a 20-some to go. Let's.
Okay, thank you very much. I've tried to now take this 60,000-plus jobs lost and distribute that in a very preliminary sort of rough guess estimate. Again, I'm not I'm almost hesitant to try to predict, you know, too far down the road here. But based on our analysis so far, if we were to break this 60,000 job loss over the coming year out across the sectors, the one thing I think that jumps out here, and the next year would be in the red bars in this chart, that's contrasted with the blue bars that show the past year and the green bars that show a one-year period between March of 2001 and March of 2002, for 2009, the only area in which we would expect to add any jobs is in the healthcare services sector. And that job growth is down to only 2,000, which is well below any rate of job increase that we've seen in that sector, including the 2001 recession year when it continued to grow quite rapidly. The largest numeric job losses here would occur in manufacturing, where about 14,000 jobs, additional jobs, would be lost. Professional and business services, which includes a wide array of different kinds of businesses, but the most cyclically sensitive component of that is the temp help employment services component. That would lose about 13,000. And trade, transportation, utilities, about 11,000. Of course, a lot of that coming in the retail trade area. Moving on to the unemployment rate issue. Again, if Minnesota matches what Global Insight is predicting for the U.S., their forecast for the unemployment rate in the first half of 2010 is an 8.7% rate of unemployment.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hein, I'm sorry.
Oh, there you go.
Going back to last year or to the last slide that you had when you showed the tremendous job loss in the last recession in the manufacturing area, do you have any sense of that particular sector, how many of those jobs were recovered or what percentage were permanent loss of those types of jobs in Minnesota?
During the past year?
In the last recession, we see the tremendous loss in the manufacturing area.
Oh,
area.
Okay. I see. Thank you. Well, we did see some upturn. That was largely in as a result of a slowing rate of job loss in some of those areas that had been hard hit by the 2001 recession, computer manufacturing, for example. But we also began to see a fairly significant surge about 2004 to 2006 in areas like electromedical device manufacturing, medical equipment. Of course, you know, the construction boom continued on until 2005, and wood products was a beneficiary of that until the bottom fell out as a result of the housing market bubble. I'd only be taking a guess, but we saw some improvement in manufacturing. We had over the year job growth in manufacturing for those years between 2004 and 2006.
Okay.
But we have since fallen below where we were at the end of 2001.
Thank you. That was my question, if we ever did get back to where we were. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. How does, I get something that I've been thinking about, and I don't know how important it is, but we passed, as I've been factored in, we passed a pretty big bonding bill. We passed the legacy legislation bill. We did a, Senator Murphy and others, and the transportation stimulus bill, you know, locally in our state. And I don't know what that amounts to, I don't know how many millions a year, 500 million, 600 million, 700 million. Does that affect some of the stuff? Have you factored it in, or maybe it's a pimple? I think it's a lot of money that we've tried to do for bridges, roads, schools, and higher, you know, the list goes on. But that's, to me, it seems like a significant number. Now, how does that fit in?
Yeah, Senator Metzen, thank you. Well, to give you a little background on where these numbers come from, we survey about 6,000 companies within Minnesota each month,
okay,
ask them, how many people do you have on your payroll? So, you know, if there are companies out there that are increasing employment as a result of actions taken, that they certainly should show up. I would note that within construction, one area that had been doing fairly well through even this past summer was in the heavy construction and the highways and so on. So we did see some positive elements in an otherwise pretty gloomy picture for construction there in the highway construction area.
Probably isn't in the pipeline yet. You know, it takes a year and a half to raise the money and the bond and build, but...
Well, that's right, too. These are all, you know, inherently somewhat backward-looking by virtue of the way we ask the questions.
This committee likes to look forward, but when we look forward at those numbers, we shut our eyes, I guess. Okay, continue on.
Okay, thank you very much. If we were to translate back to the unemployment rate picture, this 8.7% unemployment rate, although it falls slightly short of the 9% rate that we did hit at its peak in November of 1982, because we have a larger labor force, of course, this means that the number of the number of people that would be unemployed if that projection were to come to pass, we would by far exceed our previous high that was reached again back in late 1982. In fact, I mean, we're quite close now to that point that, you know, unless we see a surprisingly positive report for December, we're probably going to achieve a new all-time high in terms of the number of Minnesotans that are currently unemployed.
Mm-hmm. Staggering.
Looking at some other information on unemployment, a good leading indicator, so this may suggest something about what we would expect to see in terms of unemployment in the future, a good leading indicator that suggests continued weakness is the number of people that are filing claims for unemployment benefits. We get this information from our unemployment insurance program, and then we seasonally adjust it to take out the highly seasonal patterns that we see in these data. So this is a seasonally adjusted total number of unemployment claims given by the blue line. And then the red line is a seasonally adjusted measure of what are called SK claims, or those claims that are filed by individuals that indicate when they file that they have been permanently separated from their previous job rather than being on a temporary furlough.
Senator Saltzman, did you have a question?
Yes. A brief question, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hines.
Where in here might you be tracking the fact that some companies are cutting back on hours? I've heard from a number of small business owners who have said, rather than lay off 10 people, as a company, we're all doing a four-day work week. We're all taking a 90% pay cut, or that they're still making enough that they aren't eligible for unemployment. Is there a way for us to track that? Because I think that's a new trend, and I think we talked with during our recent business tour, and I know the commissioner talked about this shared service. Is it shared services?
Shared work.
Shared work. We talked about shared services today with Senator Bonoff, so I have that mm-hmm. that issue on my mind. Mm-hmm. But not to take a lot of time, but is there a way to track that as well? Because I think that's something that is a trend as well.
Yeah, Senator Saltzman, thanks for asking that. That has long been recognized to be a part of the economic adjustment to mm-hmm. slowdowns and something that needs to be measured. For the last 3 years, the commissioner mentioned that we work closely with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We've been testing this all employees' earnings and hours being the operational point here, series that'll be scheduled for release early next year. We have noted that there has been a declining average number of hours per work week. Although I think that tends to underemphasize the role that this does play, because layoffs often occur sort of at the lower end and with more part-time people. So you might cut all your full-time people to 35, but if you lay off all of your part-time workers, the average work week, in fact, goes up. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether this is going to clearly answer that question. We've done some analysis with what we call our wage records, where employers report to us the number of hours worked per quarter, and tried to discern that from those data. But the problem there is that we get a quarterly number of hours worked. We don't know whether that's spread over the whole quarter or it's low because they got hired halfway through the quarter and so on. So it's a challenge. We're trying to get a handle on that. But I suspect that you're absolutely right, that we're perhaps understating the impact on jobs when these employment counts that we're looking at does count a job as a job as a job just by virtue of being on the payroll, whether it's 1 hour or 40.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hine, does anybody have any figures on where the UI fund is sitting right now, where it's at? Commissioner?
Senator Rosen, yeah, we do an ongoing analysis, and I believe there is a hearing scheduled to discuss that issue. So, I'm not prepared, of course, to discuss it, but I think there's a hearing next week.
There are several hearings coming up. I don't recall in which committees they are. Is it in this committee? On the House side. The short answer is that there is about $500 million in the trust fund today. We are paying benefits, however, at a very high rate. We currently anticipate, first of all, the trust fund could be at zero, and Minnesota workers would still get paid. So there is no – workers do not need to worry. The challenge is the impact on employers and how rapidly they pay to reimburse the fund. We anticipate that the fund will have a positive balance through late 2009 or early 2010, and then it is likely we'll have to borrow from the federal government through most of 2010, depending on the pace of the recovery. Mr. Chairman, we would be happy to provide a more detailed presentation on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. It is interesting. It is complex. But the bottom line message is workers should not worry. They will get paid benefits if they are owed, because there's an automatic mechanism for borrowing from the Federal Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. There are a number of states already in that position. Minnesota is fairly solvent compared to other states, but if this downturn continues, we would be borrowing in 2010.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, it would be nice to have a summary on that at some point where we stand.
Can you figure that out, Commissioner, and get that?
Mr. Chairman, we'll provide a written summary. It is the kind of information where your members are likely to have questions, so we'll provide a summary quickly, and then you may want to have us back to address the issue in more detail or to answer your questions.
We're hearing the unemployment bill next week, aren't we, here in this committee, Brad? So maybe at that time we can get more information.
We'll schedule a short presentation at that time.
I think we're going to – aren't we paralleling the Fed's unemployment thing? And
yes.
And
Mr. Chairman,
to do that,
we've been informed that we'll, that you want to hear a bill.
We want to do that soon because apparently there's a time thing on this to get the benefits out there, and we can't wait around.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So we're going to move real fast next week on that extension bill of unemployment UI stuff. Yeah. All right, and I believe the administration is all right with that, so. Mr. Hine, we've got 5 pages to go.
Okay, thank you.
2 minutes.
Thank
two
you.
Hours
another bit of evidence on the unemployment insurance side is a fairly significant increase over the last year in the number of people, beneficiaries out there, the number of people that are receiving benefits, and also the number of people that are exhausting their benefits before they regain employment. We've seen nearly a 50% increase in both of those measures over the past year. These exhaustions, by the way, do not include they are exhaustions from the regular program and not the extensions that are now in place. I wanted to also talk a bit about the importance of what I think is an importance of understanding that all of these net changes that we're talking about, the number of jobs lost during a month and so on, belies what I think is a surprisingly high rate of what we call churn or dynamics in the economy. This is a chart that shows for the nation how many people moved out of employment between October and November. There was a 673,000 decline in the number of people indicating that they had jobs by the current population survey. Simultaneously, there was a 250,000 increase in the number of people that were unemployed, and there was a 637,000 person increase in the labor force. Those are big numbers. Now, we've certainly had larger changes on a month-to-month basis in our nation's history, but nonetheless, we certainly look at a 250,000 increase in the unemployment number as being a bit disconcerting, to say the least. But when you look at where those net changes come from, and I hope this is not a terribly confusing chart, but these arrows show, for example, that a 250,000 increase in unemployment occurred as a result of 2.5 million people that were previously employed entering the ranks of the unemployed. Okay, so rather than a 250,000 people losing their jobs and becoming unemployed, it was actually 2.5 million. Now, offsetting that was 2.2 million people that had been unemployed finding jobs. And 2.1 million unemployed people quit looking or something, and by virtue of that were no longer deemed to be unemployed, but rather not in the labor force. So underlying those net changes between October and November, 16 million people changed their work status between October and November. All right, and that doesn't include the people that might have changed from one job to another. Okay, so I think it's very important to realize that when there is an announcement that 500,000 jobs were lost nationally, that 10 or 15,000 jobs were lost in the state, that doesn't mean that there is no hiring going on and that is all the job loss that occurred. There's a significantly more than that. In kind of summary here, I'll leave you to read that. I also want to point out that there's certainly a rising number of...
Senator Scoy has a...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dr. Hine, on that churn, is there any analysis of the amount of those churns that were going down in income or salary opposed to those that were churning upwards? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Senator Scoy, you're asking whether the flows in these arrows are characterized by particular earnings rates or other demographic characteristics or economic characteristics?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, Dr. Hines, you said there was 16 million people that changed their work.
Right.
Some of them were from employment to unemployment, some from unemployment to employment, some changing jobs.
Right.
I mean, besides the 250,000 that lost their jobs, so that's obviously a net loss. But are there any of those that move downward in the pay scale, move upward in the pay scale in that churn?
Right. Senator Scoy, that good question. It would be possible by looking at all of the micro data that underlie these. These are numbers that are produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the nation as a whole, and they don't provide that kind of breakdown. But it would be an interesting research project. Absolutely.
Senator Scheid, did you have a question? Okay. Sir, yes. See, let me say something here. This is, I looked at the clock a minute ago, but forget that. I mean, this is very, very serious stuff. We've got all the time. We're going to take all the time that we need, and nobody's going to be rushed. And I think that participating senators, or I think most people have been asking a lot of good questions. So,
good. Yeah,
forget I even checked on that a minute ago. I didn't mean it that way. And take your time and ask your questions. You know what's
well, I do have
what's more important?
Two hours in the parking
jobs,
meter.
We don't have a job. Then, you know.
Which all right. One? Thank you, Senator Metz.
Which one? We can make sure they don't go by. More than five times.
Yeah, so that, yeah, go ahead.
Thank
so,
you.
Dr. Hyde.
Thank you very much. I did want to point out in this chart, I think this emphasizes, again, how much larger some of these dynamic flows are relative to the net changes. The net changes in employment are in the bars there. Net changes in unemployment, rather. We saw in May, for example, a very large increase of 800,000 unemployed people. You can see the 250,000 down there at the end. Much smaller, one-tenth the size of the regular churns or movements that occur between unemployment and employment, and employment and out of the labor force and so on. Did want to point out that there is a rising, in fact, number of unemployed people that are finding jobs. That's the red line there. The number of the unemployed people that are moving into employment has, in fact, been going up over the last year. But the blue line that represents the number of employed people that are finding themselves unemployed has gone up much more significantly, 44% compared to the 8% increase in the unemployed that have found jobs. We are not...
Senator Letts.
Excuse me?
Dr. Hine, so if I'm looking at that right, it looks like there are... the people not in the labor force who are, they decided they're going to go look for a job, that number has declined by about 10%.
It went up 10% from the previous November. It has declined over the last couple months, you're right. The green
line.
Looks
like there's a number, yeah, going down though, it looks like it. You've got at 10% number.
That should be a positive 10% increase over the previous November. Although
okay.
It's gone down since September.
Okay. I guess the number I'm most interested in is the unemployment to not in the labor force, sort of the discouragement factor,
okay,
that are looking for jobs, and they're just giving up now, and they're saying, forget it. I can't find a job. I'm not going to look anymore, at least not until I'm confident things
right.
have turned around a little bit, and I got a chance.
You're absolutely right, that that's up 24%. That the red dashed line is a measurement of those people that you're referring to that had qualified as being unemployed by virtue of not having a job, being available to work, and also having actively sought work in the last 4 weeks. Those you have to meet those requirements in order to be considered unemployed, and much of the movement from unemployment to not in the labor force, of course, is by virtue of not having looked, actively sought work for the last 4 weeks. It may be because of discouragement, right? And those numbers are certainly up at the national level quite significantly, but that continues to be a fairly small component of those people that say they would take a job if they had one but haven't looked. Much more common are reasons having to do with lack of childcare or lack of transportation as impediments to taking a job if one were found. So those people would also be included in that red dash line.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bonnet.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Dr. Hine, does that also include those who just fall off the statistics because after you're on unemployment for a certain amount of time, then we don't track you anymore?
No, Senator Bonnet, thank you. This is a survey of households that ask individuals whether they're working or not.
And
if they're not, are they looking?
Good.
It is, of course, correlated with whether you're on unemployment benefits or not, but they are two entirely separate things. We have unemployed people that are not eligible for benefits.
Right.
We have people on benefits that would not be considered to be unemployed.
Thanks.
So there's an overlap, but they're not the same thing.
Great.
And they aren't even measured in the same way.
Right. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay. This is a different measure of churn, but this is what we have available at the state level. What we have here is quarter by quarter the total number of people that have entered a job or left a job. And then in the little green bars down there, that's the net employment change. So again, I want to emphasize how much more quantitatively significant this churn is relative to the net changes that we often pay attention to. Typically, recently, we've seen about 450,000 people per quarter enter a job and leave a job within Minnesota. About 150,000 a month take a job or leave a job. It is true that when we announced last month that our net job change was a decline of 10,500 jobs, that was not good news, all right? But that came about as a result of 150,000, give or take, leaving a job, okay? But at the same time, about 140,000 then would have taken a job if 150,000 left in a month like that. I do want to point out, too, that both separations and hires are pro-cyclical, all right? What that means is that as the economy slows, they both go down. As the economy expands, they both go up. So total separations here have reduced in this economic slowdown because far fewer people are voluntarily leaving their job. All right. We're certainly seeing involuntary departures on the rise, but more than offsetting that has been a decline in voluntary departures from a job. Nobody wants to quit a job under these current circumstances. In summary, then, short term, if those current forecasts are correct, that Global Insight has produced that we have applied to our own state situation here, we'll lose about 100,000 jobs between the end of 2007 and the end of 2009. That's another 60-some thousand on top of the 38,000 lost so far. We'll add an additional approximately 70,000 unemployed persons to the very nearly 190,000 that we currently have as of November. We'll reach all-time highs in the number of unemployed as well as UI claimants, recipients, beneficiaries, and exhaustees. I should perhaps mention that the National Employment Situation Report for December will come out on Friday. One leading indicator of that is a preliminary number produced by a payroll processing and accounting firm called ADP, and For November, they had predicted a job loss of about 230,000. It turned out to be 530-some thousand. For December, they just came out with their report today, and they're predicting just under 700,000 jobs lost.
Before that, Senator Letts.
Dr. Hein, do you have any information on the job losses that connect to whether the individual losing the job is the head of a household or the primary income earner in the household?
Senator Letts, we don't collect that information. I think we have a need to use some of those individual responses that I mentioned earlier in response to another question to get at those kinds of questions, but we have not been able to advance that. I do want to, now that you asked a question, referring to the underemployment question. While we've seen the national unemployment rate go up to 6.7%, there is a measure that adds to that people that are working part-time, that prefer full-time, that have discontinued looking because they're discouraged or have other impediments to working. And that rate hit 12.5%. I did some sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations from what data we did have for the state, and a comparable measure, a rough guess, would be about 11.5% for Minnesota.
Is that on top of the unemployment rate?
No, that would include the quote, officially unemployed, those people actively looking.
Okay, so unemployed.
Plus underemployed.
The number you gave
right,
us.
Right. Those measures don't try to account for another type of underemployment, and that is people that may have skills well above the position that they're currently working in. But, with that, that's sort of my short-term prognosis. If I could just quickly turn to a longer term, looking out beyond the length of time that we take to recover, and look at some of the demographic trends that are going to impact our labor markets in the next decade or two. Of course, a lot of this information then comes from the State Demographer's Office and Tom Gillespie. But we'll see here that we're going to experience a significant slowing in our labor force. In the labor force growth rate, simply because of demographic changes that are hard to avoid. We're going to see a much older workforce as all of us baby boomers start to retire or get to closer to retirement age. A more ethnically diverse workforce as we see a slowing natural rate of population growth alongside rising immigration rates. Although it's hard to imagine, a time when we're going to possibly be facing severe labor shortages rather than the surpluses that we currently are looking at. And that will give rise to new challenges in terms of matching worker skills and job requirements. Here's a chart. Again, this is from the state demographer's data showing growth in the labor force in five-year increments. During the two decades between 1980 and 2000, we added 707,000 workers. In the next two decades, or between 2010 and 2030, we're projected to add less than a third as many. I actually wonder whether it may not be worse than that, since the state demographer's calculations assume an increasing rate of labor force participation, and in contrast, Since 2001, we've seen a steady decrease in our labor force participation rate, a smaller share of our working age population that are either working or looking for work. So in order for us to even achieve that 226,000 additional workers over the next two decades, we're going to have to see a turnaround in this diminishing labor force participation rate. Since 2001 and most recently, that nearly 4 percentage point decrease in our labor force participation rate translates into about 120,000 workers having left the labor force. So what does that mean? Lately, we've been averaging about 30,000 new workers per year. Okay, so on a month-to-month basis, we typically look for about a 2,500 to 3,000 job increase as being sufficient to absorb natural labor force growth in order to maintain full employment or a given unemployment rate. We would need to see that many jobs added per month. But that's going to slow to the point where between 2020 and 2025, we're going to be adding only 3,000 new workers per year rather than 3,000 new workers per month. Okay, so our rate of growth then is going to be severely restricted by the fact that we're just simply not going to have new workers. We're also going to see our workforce getting dramatically older. You can see that over the next for the past 5 years and the next 5 years, almost all growth in our labor force, and if you look over the next 10 years, essentially all of our labor force growth is in the 55 and above age category, all right? 10 years between 2015 and 2025, we're actually going to see a decline in the number of young workers, those between 16 and 34. So almost all of our labor growth over the next decade is going to be in that older cohort. One in three of the workforce of 2035 are already working today. All right. The P16 pipeline of skilled workers, the traditional one of the important sources of new skills, is essentially going to disappear, at least for the next 10 years, so that reskilling incumbent or existing workers is going to be increasingly crucial. Now, where are these people going to be working? We currently produce 10-year employment projections through 2016. We're in the process of updating that to 2018. This chart shows the projected employment growth rates across the different sectors. You can see that manufacturing and natural resources and mining are the only two areas that are expected to shrink. But in numeric terms, all right, because of the size of the sector, education and healthcare services is going to be the predominant source of new employment between now and 2016. Over 3 of every 10 new jobs will be in that area. With that, I will have exhausted all my available time and parking meter.
Bart, committee recently toured a workshop development center, and I guess their hits are up about 40, 50, 60% the last. And Commissioner McElroy was along with us as a lot of the members, so it was kind of, again, staggering news to see that the demand over at that particular one in Dakota County. So. Yes, and I think it's true all over the state, I would guess, at all the centers.
We'll face yeah, very I different mean, challenges once boy. We weather these, yeah.
We were waiting for some good news, Doctor.
Sorry.
But, yeah. It's very challenging.
So just a comment, Mr.
Chair. Senator Saltzman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. You know, when we see these numbers like 100,000 jobs lost, we see them on paper and it's a number, but obviously there's many stories behind this. And I think that if we look at this and feel depressed, as I heard someone mention over to my left here, we have to look at where there are opportunities for this committee and also our education committees, our higher ed groups to really work together with our business community, with our educators, with our public, because I heard earlier talking about what happened in 2005 or 2006. We're looking forward, and there's an opportunity for us to look at these and say, so what could we be doing now? And I think it's important that we face the realistic facts, that we look at these figures, and instead of just trying to look for the happy news, the good news, which we always want to look for, is say, let's confront these head on. And what do we need to do as a state to really ensure that we're using all of our taxpayers wisely, but also reaching out and looking for initiatives? So I know that, you know, all the members on this committee sit on various other committees as well. And I think in this coming session, this is an excellent way to start out. It is very troubling. It's very concerning. But I think that we say, like, we roll up our sleeves, and what do we do with this information? It's if we just look at this and file this PowerPoint away, and we don't come back to this and continue to say, what decisions can we make in this session and going out, and not looking just in the next 2 years, but look out 10 years and 15 years? Because the kids, as we talked about here, who are just entering the workforce, this is their future.
Right.
So I appreciate you being here, and it is something that I think is very concerning. But let's not just say we can't do anything about it. That's not
Thank
the Minnesota
you, Senator
way.
Salter. I put those dynamic measures in there really for that mm-hmm. purpose, to show that, you know, losing 100,000 jobs is something to come to grips with and deal with. But at the same time, it's not just that 100,000 jobs were lost. There were a lot of jobs that are being created at the same time that a lot of jobs are being lost. That's a natural state of affairs. We were losing more jobs in the boom period of the 1990s than we have been recently. You know, so that those dynamics that underlie these net changes do represent the opportunities to take action and hope that this will right itself.
Senator Saltzman, I agree with you, and I think there will be a lot of eyes looking at this committee to be doing things and being innovative and coming up with thoughts and ideas, because that's what I think we're all about, business, industry, and jobs. So, Senator Cook.
Mr. Chair, and this is maybe not a question for Dr. Hine, but do you have a breakdown of, in the state of Minnesota, what percentage of people are employed, small business, large business, government, or is that?
Senator Cook, yes, we do. We break out our employment by the sizes. I don't have the numbers on me.
Okay.
Certainly, some of the charts showed a breakdown by the major sectors, healthcare and government and so on. There's much more refined disaggregation of our employment distribution that's available. So
would that be possible to get?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes.
I would really appreciate
yeah.
that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, just out of curiosity, Senator Metzen mentioned bonding bills and the like that we do around here for job creation. I have two questions. One is, if we create substantial amounts of, say, $1 billion bonding bill, how does that fit into that scenario of people getting their jobs back, number one, or going back to work? And number two, are the people that are losing jobs right now, are there jobs available for them if they were able to get retraining? So in other words, are there jobs available in the workforce that we aren't filling because people don't have the qualifications, or are there just no jobs for them? So my first question is, can
Senator Tomasoni,
what kind of impact can we have?
I think your question is, would a bonding bill be an effective fiscal stimulus that would raise employment?
Mm-hmm.
I certainly think that there are a lot of people converging on Washington, D.C. that are hoping that is the case. And monetary policy has been shown to be somewhat relatively ineffective. I won't get into the effectiveness or efficacy of tax cuts as a stimulus, but certainly a from my personal perspective, an expenditure bill, whether it be through tax revenues or bonding.
How to get ready for this?
So job creation
seems to be the one remaining option that has some.
My second question was: is there any indication that there's actually job availability for people who are losing their jobs, provided they got some kind of retraining?
Yes, absolutely. A point again at the relatively high number of people that are entering employment. Even currently, we still continue to see about 150,000 Minnesotans finding jobs each month. We conduct a vacancy survey each 6 months, and while we don't have the final results for the fourth quarter, the current survey round, we do see those numbers dropping off, but they have remained at about the 50,000 level for the last few years. Certainly some of those areas that you would expect to see more opportunity, like healthcare. Lately, a lot of the IT occupations, certainly far fewer production and construction opportunities over the last couple of years. But there do remain jobs that people are moving into at a fairly fast rate. And vacancies that people are reporting to us are available.
And in spite of that all, we're still expecting 226,000 to be unemployed in 2011 or whatever the number was.
Yes, yes. While we're adding jobs, we're also losing jobs, yes.
Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You talked about these 100,000 jobs that we're creating. How many, have you done any look as to what kind of jobs those were and how many people were being put in, jobs that they were probably well overqualified for?
As Senator Murphy, we were talking about the difficulty in identifying those people that are underemployed by virtue of being overqualified for the job that they currently hold. That is something that is a difficult thing to measure. We can tell a lot about the trends in employment, and the quality of jobs by virtue of whether there's relatively large job losses in high-paid areas with lesser job losses or even job growth in lower-paid areas. The truth of the matter lately is that we're seeing job losses across the board, and everything from leisure and hospitality to professional and business services and financial activities, although financial activities has been one area within the state that we've not experienced the same decrease that we have seen nationally.
Well, Mr. Murphy. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Doctor, on that point, is that because some of our financial institutions, I'm not going to name them, but because they're in a stronger position and didn't buy into a lot of the things that went wrong?
That has been my reading and my interpretation of what I have seen about some of the major players in our financial sector, that they were not engaged in the same kinds of activities that have impacted many of the other regions and bank holding
companies. Murphy.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Doctor, my last thing, and back to the question before, this goes back to the person who's a licensed engineer that's working at the convenience store because they can't find work. In the future, if there's a way of finding out about, that group of people, I think everybody here would be very interested in hearing that, the underemployment numbers.
Absolutely. I think certainly matching people's skill sets with the right job is a lot of what the labor exchange system and job banks and more efficient ways of connecting the two sides of labor markets is all about, and being able to accomplish that even in the absence of good measurement, which is a difficult thing to do, is still an important goal.
But there's a lot of that, Senator Murphy, a lot of it. Huh? Boy, right. People are proud. They want to work somewhere, and convenience store flipping hamburgers,
It's the bread line.
Put some bread on the table, Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that the longer-term challenges here, there's a lot of short-term pain going on right now, and we have to do what we can to mitigate that. But the longer-term challenges are perhaps more daunting because the economy is going to be cyclical. We can have an impact to some degree on that, but to a large degree, government itself doesn't really control a lot of the economy cycles. There are bigger issues there. But we can have a real big impact on the longer-term trends that Dr. Hine has pointed out in terms of dealing with the longer-term workforce or labor force shortage. He's not describing a shortage in demand for workers in demand. He's describing, as I understand it, a shortage in the availability of workers to fill a growth in demand. So we may see an unemployment rate that drops dramatically down the road, but it's dropped so low because we don't have the workers to fill the jobs that would make us more productive and more healthy as an economy and as a community to live and work in. And so I think that goes back to what we do in terms of long-term investments on behalf of the state and the people of Minnesota. When you get to questions of early childhood education, K-12 education, making sure MNSCU's got sufficient resources to address the skills training and meeting the needs of the businesses to retrain workers who are temporarily unemployed. When it comes to University of Minnesota and the building of the having programs that will retain the skilled students coming out of the high school programs and that will attract students from around the world to come here, workers from around the world. It goes to the B-1B visa program or the H-1B visa program on the federal government to allow foreign workers with special skills to come in here that helps us build the intellectual and the workforce and economic engine in Minnesota. These are all things which we can do and which I think we have to keep at the top of our minds as we work our way through this legislative session and make important decisions about what we're going to do with our budget here. Because if this legislative session ends up all about cutting our long-term investments, what is projected now by Dr. Hine and Dr. Gillespie is going to be a lot worse down the road than currently projected. I think we're already seeing some of the impact of past disinvestment in those long-term physical and human infrastructure development, and I think we got to be cautious we don't make it a whole lot worse.
Good points.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheck.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if you've maybe this isn't what you've done or it hasn't entered into your research here, but what about the immigrant people who come here? I mean, to me, it's an issue of labor and people trying to improve their situation coming here for work. I know many of them undocumented, but I can't help thinking that one of the things we might do simply in terms of preparing for a shortage of workers is perhaps helping some of the people who are here get an education so that they can be skilled workers. The best student I teach when I do substitute teaching comes from a family of undocumented workers. She's one of the strongest students in the building. She's going to have to go to school out of the country. Doesn't make sense to me. Have you taken into consideration the fact that there are people here and they're here because they want to work, and they actually... many are working.
Well, Senator Scheid, I can say that that sustained growth in our employment level throughout the 1990s far exceeded our natural population growth rate and our natural labor force expansion. We were a destination of choice for a lot of immigrants that looked at us as being a desirable location, part because we had a relatively low unemployment rate, that there was an indication that we had opportunities here. We've certainly seen a diminishment of that, but if I'm to take Tom Gillespie's projections as credible, and I do, we're going to become more reliant on that as a source of that, of what little labor force growth we will see in the upcoming decade. That's a very important consideration.
Should we be trying to increase?
Yeah, any further questions?
Well, thank you, Senator Metzen, and members of the committee for the generosity with your time.
Very good discussion, I believe, this afternoon. Okay, next up, Mark Loftus, Director of the Business Community Development. Indeed. We had some auditors' questions, was it last year? And I think there was some language put in the tax bill, and I guess we want to know what's going on and what's fixed up and what's not fixed and how are we doing. Good afternoon, Mr.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm the director of the Business and Community Development Division within DEED. I brought up with me Neil Young. Neil is the acting director of the Jobs and Business Finance Office, and he'll, if there are questions, he can help me with some of the technical aspects of the presentation. But I appreciate the chance to talk to you about this, about Jobs Eat today, because clearly there was considerable discussion last session in the legislative auditor's report. And I think at the inaugural meeting of this committee, it's a good time to tell you the things that we have done in the past months since the session ended, to summarize how the 2008 legislative session changes have been folded into what we've accomplished, what we're doing, but also to talk about the administrative aspect of the program. And I'll jump, I know time being what it is, I'll move as quickly as I can, Mr. Chairman. I'll talk about the legislative changes that passed in the tax bill, our own administrative activities, and also give you a flavor of some of the forward-looking issues that we're facing with the program, as well as some specific facts about the state of the Jobs Eat program in terms of compliance and those that are out of compliance and what we're doing about that. Just to summarize, this is a list of all of what was in the legislative auditor's lengthy and we believe very good analysis of the Jobs Eat program. The problems were well documented in their report, including examination of whether the program's value, the benefits to the state exceeded the cost of giving Jobs Eat, and compliance and monitoring and verification of data. All of those issues, I think it'd be fair to say that DEED agreed with, and the legislative consensus that we perceived and the facts that we agreed with, the point that we agreed with, were that DEED needed to take a lot more oversight, more direct involvement with the program to ensure that it does what we hope it will all accomplish. And I'll just give you a flavor. We talked with Dr. Hine about some of the good news possibly within the state, and there are some good examples, and I just wanted to put this one up as an illustration of a success. This is a project that will be in Faribault, in the industrial park in Faribault. Moventus is a Finnish company. They are in the supply chain in the wind turbine manufacturing business. They'll be making gearboxes for those turbine components in Faribault, with at least 100 jobs to start and probably more as they move forward. But it's one of our very recent projects, an example of the kind of thing that this is a project that was in play with Minnesota versus Iowa, just put it bluntly. And they will tell you, if asked, very clearly that Jobs Eat was a critical factor in helping them decide to locate this project in Minnesota. So we're very proud of that, and I'll talk some more about examples of projects as we discuss the current situation at the end. I've summarized here in the next two slides the legislative outcomes, and these were in Chapter 366, Article 5, the tax bill. Some of the points of some of the concern the legislative auditor raised that we all agreed with, that needed to be dealt with. And one of them was the business subsidy agreements that had been enacted by local governments, had been amended by local governments without any prohibition to the contrary. So if they had a company not meeting their goals, they amended those agreements without any oversight from anyone, including Deed. There was no restriction on their ability to do that. So your tax bill last year prohibited that from happening, and I'll talk about some of the exceptions of how that can occur, how we can amend agreements. The other two points on the slide talk about a very kind of a practical change in the tax bill. Recognize that there are projects that may not achieve 100% of their job goals, but they get most of the way there, somewhere north of 50%. And the provisions that pass give us the authority to have a shorter duration of benefits for the program in proportion to the degree that they met their goals. So that was kind of a very practical way to say if you didn't get 100% compliance with your job goal, that you shouldn't have to be dismissed entirely from the program. But I'll talk about how that works with other parts of the clawback as well as I get deeper into the presentation. The other parts that relate to that passed in the tax bill gave the state auditor and the legislative auditor increased access to tax data, tax form data, as well as unemployment insurance data that they need. As you know, the state auditor, since the beginning of the program, has had the requirement to audit every project every year, but they didn't have the access to the data to have the authority to access the data, and they now do, and that was a very positive change. Also, there are new reports that are required of the business. One form had been a voluntary form. It was the so-called M500 form that had been a voluntary form where the business was asked to identify their expected benefits under the program. Now that's mandatory, and that's a report that is submitted in October 15th, I believe, to Revenue. And the other report is the December report where the business certifies to Revenue that they are whether they are in compliance with the program. And so Revenue is just getting their first batch of those in and has not completed all of the review of that yet, nor of the October 15th reports, but they're in the process of doing that. And I think expect to report to the legislature in February on those first batch of reports and what they've found. As far as administrative changes, as I mentioned during the session last year, we had created a new office to deal directly with Job Z and folded it into our business finance group. This is a group that Neil is the acting director of. We've also had meetings around the state this summer in July and August to talk with economic developers and anybody else who would listen about the kind of changes that we were proposing to have, in which Deed would have greater oversight. And that led to a lot of good feedback and was helpful in crafting the process that we have today. And all of these changes then were put into the state register in October, kind of our way of announcing and officially notifying the public and interested audiences of the changes that we're making. And again, folding together all of the legislative changes and the Deed administrative changes. And we have met with the state auditor, the legislative auditor, this fall to give them an understanding of where Deed is going with the program. Particularly, the state auditor needs to work with us closely and in their monitoring of each project. So I think we have a good starting relationship with them to share data, and that will be ongoing. One point I wanted to make here on this slide is the authority that we have in the Job Z statute. When we began the program, the bill that passed in 2003 gave us the authority to establish a lot of procedures in the program without requiring formal rulemaking. And for the most part, we didn't use that authority. We used it largely at the point of the initial designation of zones. And there's a lot of other opportunity in that authority that we didn't rely upon. And we are now, when I talk about these administrative changes that Deed is making, that authority resides in 116J.314. And we are now using that for our ability to move forward. I want to talk about the administrative process in terms of the applications that we are now working through. the point that we are going to get to, that we're at right now, and it will move, as we move forward, is that DEED has established a process in which we will receive applications and act upon and approve or deny.
10 after 2.
But hopefully, by that point, approve all of the projects that meet statewide criteria. And there are some fundamental parts of this analysis that we're doing. And I should say that this looks very much like an application that we would otherwise receive for our Minnesota Investment Fund program. We ask about financing, about project cost, about the number of jobs that they propose to create. And so we're asking some basic questions now. Like, is there a need for job Z? Can the local government demonstrate why they would use this exceptional tool to provide these benefits to this business? Why is that necessary that be done? Do the benefits to the state exceed the cost? There's really two ways for us to look at this. The first is, does the benefit basically to the state exceed the cost of giving them job Z? And we are using a tool that's been available to us for a while, and the acronym is REMI, or we call it the REMI model in our department. It stands for Regional Econometric Modeling, Inc. That model allows us to take the information the company gives us as far as their expected use of the program and all of the project parameters, the jobs, the investment, the construction costs, the timing of all of that, to determine whether the direct and indirect value to the state exceeds the cost of the job Z benefits. So there's kind of a first threshold, is the state's value greater than the cost of giving them job Z? The second part of that, though, that we use in the application process is a return on investment. Does the value to the state, to what degree, if it is a net gain for the state, to what degree is there a net gain? What is the ratio of that gain over the cost? So that's part of our application process. We also ask and evaluate whether other assistance might be more appropriate. Is something like tax abatement more appropriate? Is a local revolving loan fund? Is there some other tool that might work as well as Job Z, or perhaps better, because we're trying not to provide Job Z benefits if we don't need to do that, to induce that investment in the state? We ask about competition, local and regional competition. Are there competitors that would be injured if we offered Job Z to this business? And already in the first couple of months of this process, we have rejected an application from one business that was proposing to receive Job Z. And I don't want to be specific if I don't have to be today about the business. It's not fair to them. But the point was they had other competitors in the region that were in the same line of business serving the same market, not retail, but serving the same end purpose. And it didn't seem necessary that they receive Job Z, so we rejected that application. And all of these factors fit into a scoring system where we're weighting the number and wages of the jobs, the return on the investment, value versus the cost, and also community distress. And I should point out, you talk about community distress, that helps us get toward the targeting element that was discussed last session. In the community distress area, we give them points for, there's three different factors, population loss, unemployment in excess of the statewide average, and household income below the state average. So if you have one, two, or three of those factors, you get more points in the scoring system. So it's a way for us to give credit for those counties, those areas that are more distressed. So in theory, you could have a smaller number of jobs in a more distressed county than in a project than you could have in a relatively more prosperous county. You lose points if you're in a community area without distress, and gain points for having a higher level of return on investment and number of jobs.
So, question from Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the benefit exceeding the cost, I see you've got the state there. Is there any requirement on how the local community assesses their cost benefit, or is that completely up to them?
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chair, Senator Skoy,
Mr. Loftus.
The evaluation that we get in the application is there is an assessment asking the community to identify how this fits into their needs and priorities. It's not a statistical measure as kind of the statewide tool that we use. The REMI model itself is a statewide analysis because of the number of suppliers and relationships of how money flows in the state. we did actually take something out of the requirement that had been in our program before, and that was the community or the deal evaluator that the legislative auditor found just didn't really get any value. So we kind of turned that into questions in the application process. You want to comment on that, Neil?
Madam Chair and members of the committee. Basically,
And if you'd introduce yourself.
Oh, yeah, sure. Neil Young, Acting Director of Jobs and Business Finance at DEET. The deal evaluator, in addition to being found to be ineffective, and in some cases there was concern that communities could game the system, so to speak, really we decided to consider those factors elsewhere. There are factors that are in statute, and they're considered throughout the application process. But the ROI itself is done at a statewide level.
Madam Chair, but I did hear you say that in part of the application process, the local communities are considering how it fits into them and how the costs and the benefits fit into what they're doing. And I'm seeing the commissioner nodding his head yes. So.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, that's correct.
Right, Mr. Thank you.
And I should also say that we are trying to preserve the local origination of projects in this whole process. We very much support the idea of community-based development, and they don't come to us unless the local government sponsors the application. So.
Okay, thank you.
So in summary, we are approving all of the JOBSY applications, and we'll go forward, standardized agreement for all business subsidies and compliance. Let me just, in the interest of time, move into this. I've already talked about some of these points about scoring applications. It's a way for us to quantify the value, to put some state-level criteria into our process. There was a lot of criticism last session about the business subsidy agreements not being standardized across the state, and we worked with the AG's staff to develop one template that everybody has to use. It's basically a fill-in-the-blank, jobs, wages, capital investment. There will no longer be 100 or 200-page development agreements that are attached to JOBSY. We had a tough time monitoring that if they're part of the JOBSY agreement, if it's something that doesn't pertain to the JOBSY program, but it's in the agreement, then the whole thing could become void. So that was a problem. So we tried to deal with that. We've also come up with better definition of some of the factors that were in appropriately criticized, like defining what an employee is or if we should allow contracted services employees to become eligible for counting toward JOBSY. And the answer is no. We can't count a firm that's providing services to that company as creating jobs. We're not counting student workers, any of those non-full-time types of positions. So that's been a new definition we've come to. We've also gotten a lot farther with the compliance side. We've revised the business assistance form specifically to be used on JOBSY. We've tightened up the anniversary date schedule by which jobs or businesses report to us, so we can tell on a more timely basis that we are achieving or not achieving the goals. They're not achieving the goals. And we also mentioned the reports that revenue is getting as well. Kind of summarizes where the program is in terms of the compliance. And this, the next slide has specific numbers of companies, but there are really three categories of being out of compliance with JOBSY. And this is, our staff have done a lot of work in this last 6-7 months to get to this point. But the first category is if the business is still operating and is substantially operating at 50, and more than 50% of their goals have been attained, we have the ability to reduce the duration of benefits that they receive. And there are, well, you'll see on the next slide, there are currently 5 projects that are still operating that have been given reduced duration of benefits. The second category is businesses that are still operating but are somewhat south of 50% of their compliance with their goals. Now, they're still operating. They're still doing what the business intended to do, but they're operating at a vastly reduced level. And under these circumstances, those businesses would be terminated. There are 11 that have been terminated from JOBSY, that their benefits end. They're not subject to clawback under this provision because they're still substantially operating in the zone. Their activity exists in the zone. But if you think about the timing of this idea of this proportional duration of Job Z benefits, we're at a point where we're about halfway through the program. So if a business started on 2004, January 1st, there were some that were almost in that time frame. To talk about proportionate reduction of benefits when they're at 25%, this doesn't make any sense. So it's more practical to say they're terminated, they're done, they're out of the program. And the last group is actually the largest number in the program in terms of noncompliance. Those that have closed or in some way are not meeting the statutory goals are no longer a qualified business. There are 46 projects in this category, some that have closed down, that have shut the doors, stopped operating in that way, or left the state. Those businesses, again, 46 of them, they are subject to clawback by revenue. Revenue's determination of whether they do that is based on examination of industry trends, of natural disasters, loss of major customers or suppliers, all factors that revenue can consider in that clawback process.
So just a question, Mr. Loftus. Yep. Since these are changes, didn't you have contracts with these businesses who came in earlier? Is this going forward with contracts, or is it retroactive to businesses that have applied and been accepted into the Job Z program?
Madam Chair, this applies to all the businesses since day one. And for those that we have reduced duration of benefits or the termination, those all, for the reduced benefits ones, those are amended agreements that we establish.
Okay.
I'm not sure if there's any other mechanics to describe there, Neil.
Madam Chair, there is a difference there. The application process only applies to new projects coming in.
Right.
But the reporting changes and the substantial level of activity and the zone requirements, those in the legislation from last year, those were retroactive to January 1st, 2004, so they apply to everybody.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the next slide summarizes.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Mr. Loftus, do we know what percentage of the Job Z projects are in complete compliance of their business subsidy agreement that they have?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, that's 314. Total compliance as of our examination of their 2007 business subsidy reports, data that they supplied to us in the spring of 2008. And that's out of a total of 376 original total projects in the program.
That was a fast response, Madam Chair. In writing, I got it.
Thank you, Senator
Bach. With it, we could always be so quick, Senator Bach. And that identifies the other numbers that we talked about in the program. But we have the other number about those 314 fully compliant projects is the number of new jobs in those businesses. The actual number that they had proposed to create was somewhere less than that. Was something like 5,500, I think, in the commitment to that. But those that have succeeded have done pretty well. They've created more than what they anticipated. It's those problem projects, the 62 that are in some level of noncompliance. But I am very happy to be able to report these numbers to you today because last year, sitting here, I couldn't have done that. We hadn't had the compliance activity that we hope to get to, that we are at. Today. The one, and this is kind of, I told you the good news about a project like Moventus and other projects. When we look at those 314 today, we would suspect that when we get the reports in spring of 2009 now, we're going to have a lot more difficulty saying that we have full compliance at that level. We can't say for sure. In fact, revenue has not yet examined all of the December reports that they've received, but we would anticipate that a share of those, somewhere maybe 20-25%, might be in a state of being out of compliance because of the current state of the economy. So given that, one thing that we wanted to talk to the committee about is the fact that in statute, we no longer have the direct authority, as the commissioner of deed no longer has the direct authority to offer an extension. Now, that was in the original Job Z legislation, but in the amendment of the clawback sections that pertain to the partial benefits, if they didn't fully meet their goals, it took out the language that would have given us that authority. And I'm talking to staff at Revenue, they think that was, we think it was just an inadvertent change. We'd like you to consider that that be something we have the authority to do. Because there are, I guarantee there are going to be companies that, that are great businesses, and I could identify some in among the committee members here that potentially would fall out of compliance just because of the economy. Great businesses that have experienced a downturn, and so that, that is an issue we'd like the committee to think about as we go ahead. Also, I just put up on the slide the fact that DEED is using this and working with local governments to make this a selective tool. It was never intended for everybody. We don't think it was used for everybody, but probably far more companies got into the program because it wasn't state, there weren't statewide criteria to manage the program. And so we are using it selectively. In 2008, there were 27 projects that are part of the Job Z approval. Most of those were in the first half of the year, by the way. So before DEED was directly doing the application process, we are now, and before the session ended. As you probably have heard, the governor's Job Z initiative would governor's recommending to extend that to the green initiative, and that would be the recommendation there is that it be in a statewide basis to help us attract some of the renewable energy projects that, like a Moventis, that we can attract. So that will certainly be a subject of considerable discussion here.
And a question from Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would that be a weighting of the scales comparable to the distressed counties in weighting, or how would you implement that portion of Job Z?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, we're looking at the green Job Z as a separate tool, not as a distressed community tool, if you will, more as a green business investment tool. So if the company would locate in Roseau, great. If it would locate in South Minneapolis, because that's where they need to be, wherever that might be, that's it's intended for more of an industry focus than a distressed focus.
But, Madam Chair, what I heard you say when you were talking about the distressed area portion of Job Z is they get a higher rating factor for the project when you're scoring it. Is the green jobs going to get some kind of higher rating factor in the scoring, or are they just, I mean, what's going to be the criteria for determining those projects versus other ones?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, we'd have to develop a separate scoring system. They wouldn't be folded in with the other Job Z projects. It would be yet to be developed criteria that would be around green businesses.
So a similar question perhaps is that we had a hearing over the interim on some of the investor tax credits. Do you see anything that if a company were to qualify for Job Z, they may not be eligible for some of these other tax incentive programs, or just something to think about? Is that in any of the proposals, or do you see that as an issue?
Madam Chair, we haven't gone there to say if you're eligible for one, you're not eligible for another. Mm-hmm. That just hasn't really arisen yet. We actually we hope that businesses would kind of move through the spectrum of mm-hmm. whether they're green or not, move through the spectrum of early stage assistance, getting started, getting some venture capital, kind of move into the continuum where they're at manufacturing or construction. So in some ways, like in the case of Moventis, we're using Minnesota Investment Fund, we're using business infrastructure grants as of under the bonding bill from last year, Job Z, maybe Job Skills Partnership. We want to make sure we win these projects.
Right.
So that's the discussion to be had.
I just ask if there's been any discussion of that.
That's a point to be discussed.
Yeah. And Senator Buck.
Madam Chair, Mr. Loftus, do you have a scatter map of those 27 new Job Z projects from last year so the committee can see kind of where they were?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we don't have that. We have a list. We just haven't charted it yet. We could. We can do that for you.
Good.
Okay. That would be helpful. All right. And are there other questions from the committee? Okay, with that, I think we are about to adjourn. We will be meeting on Monday at 12:30. We have some business. And also next week on Wednesday is the a legislative retreat, which will have an economic development focus. So I hope all of you have thought about attending. It is just for legislators. It's a chance for us to really focus on some things that will be before this committee. So with that, meeting adjourned.
Don't leave any incriminating evidence.
All the jobs going to kick in. That we put in. Maybe Colonel Steele's that. When's that 30,000 jobs?
General.
Will that be kicking in one of these days?
Vermont and Iron.
Think about that.
That's a big
city. I'd better with it than without it.
I can fix it.
We're in a room over there.
Exactly.